First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Supporters of Duval's school chief rally in her defense. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on the drama at Douglas Anderson High School, an investigation and a special board meeting. Give us a call as we talk schools this morning at 549-2937. Then later, combating Lyme disease and the controversy around diagnosis. A new film screening this week on the UNF campus will tell you about the latest research and why it's controversial. That and more ahead. But first this morning, Duval County School Board members are set to meet Wednesday to discuss the ongoing controversy at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, where multiple teachers have been accused of inappropriate conduct. They say they want to determine who should be held accountable. At the same time, supporters of Duval County School Superintendent Diana Green are rallying to her side. What's going on with this? Joe McClain, WJXT Channel 4, has been covering the story and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the special Duval School Board meeting this week. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Already getting your tweets at Melissa and Jax. We'll get to those in a bit. All right. So there's been an investigation going on inside Douglas Anderson High School for some time about a former teacher accused of inappropriately touching a minor. Two other teachers are also under investigation. They have not been named. So against this backdrop, the school board is meeting tomorrow.
Then, and we first heard about this meeting, me and a couple other members of the media heard about this meeting on Friday from some high-level people in the district. The meeting, we were told, was going to be in direct response to the ongoing situation at Douglas Anderson High School. And when they hold special meetings like this, any meeting of the Duval County School Board has to be noticed to the public at least 48 hours ahead of that meeting taking place. So what we saw yesterday, right at 1 p.m., 48 hours before this meeting would be scheduled, that notice dropped. So right at the very last moment, the 48 hours to the hour is when this meeting was noticed. Now, the agenda, the subjects that they are supposed to be talking about is hiring a third-party counsel. I'm reading directly from the agenda. Hiring a third-party counsel as a result of recent events at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. It also says an update from general counsel, scope of work, timeline, and cost. So a very comprehensive meeting going to happen Wednesday at 1 o'clock. The reason that everybody's hearing about Superintendent Green is because when we were, when me and my colleagues at News for Jax were talking to our sources at Duval County Public Schools, there is a big sentiment among members of the board we're hearing that Dr. Green should be in some way held responsible for how the district responded to the situation at Douglas Anderson. Now,
why is that? Why is this her responsibility, the school principal?
That's a great question. So I'm going off of a lot from memory because this goes back all the way to 2018. Now, remember 2018, the horrible tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that led state lawmakers to pass the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School Safety Act. That created the Office of Safe Schools. And it also, a year later, essentially it kicked in a lot of requirements for schools to report the crimes, the incident, you know, anything that was found to be a substantial a crime that happened on a school campus. The state wanted all that information from all the school districts. And so it wanted all the school districts to send in their crime data and information. The next year, at the request of Governor Ron DeSantis, the Florida Supreme Court impaneled a grand jury basically to look over to make sure all the school districts in the state, 67 school districts, were following that and were turning in all of their information. Now, when that report, there was actually three different chapters of this report that came out, Duval County Public Schools was singled out. Many listeners probably remember the coverage of this in 2020 and 2021 when these interim reports were released. Duval County was called out because it was seen that a lot of the crimes that were happening in Duval County public schools were not being reported as crimes, not going into that state database. So that really hit the district hard reputational-wise. Now, the district says it reported all these problems. It self-reported these issues with how it reports crimes and corrected them. They even brought in a third-party auditor to come in and look over how the district was handling this, how the district was following that, and make sure it was reporting properly. A few months ago, they gave their final report. The audit found the district's all good. It's reporting all the crimes. Well, fast forward to the situation with Jeffrey Clayton. This is the
former Douglas Anderson teacher.
Former Douglas Anderson music teacher, longtime music teacher, accused of multiple instances. The issue here is after the reports came out about Clayton, Clayton was terminated. And in that termination notice, the district mentioned that there was a previous incident that Jeffrey Clayton was involved with in 2021. Now, on last Wednesday, stay with me here. Mm-hmm. Last Wednesday, News 4 Jax got a hold of a memo from the state. The state basically calling out Duval County Public Schools saying, this incident you mentioned in 2021 with this guy, Jeffrey Clayton, why wasn't that entered into the CESEAR system? That's the school environment reporting safety incident reporting. It's an acronym.
Yeah.
But that's the
okay.
beta.
We
that's
get the gist.
That's
yeah.
the database that the
so
that
they're
the
saying
state
you the
keeps.
School they're saying DCPS should have reported this incident. You report the Department of Children and Families determined the incident didn't rise to the level of needing to be reported.
Now the Department of Children and Families and the Department of Professional Standards, the district told those agencies. Now, the district tells me, clarified with me yesterday, that when the district did its investigation, the district did not find that this incident, the 2021 incident with Clayton, where Clayton was described as putting his arm around a student, rubbing their back, and telling that student that they were beautiful, they found that that was substantiated, but not it didn't rise to the level, they say, of sexual harassment, which is what it would cross that line and make it into a crime. Now, you may disagree, but that's the district's explanation for why it didn't do.
Okay.
And
we'll go to calls in a moment at 549-2937. Superintendent Dr. Diana Green, as you report, has been leading the district since 2018. She was named Florida Superintendent of the Year in 2021. Her contract was just renewed last summer for another 4 years. She also received plaudits for successfully shepherding through a half-cent sales tax increase for school improvement and construction in a very difficult political environment. Her supporters are rallying to her side, including State Representatives Angie Nixon and former State Senator Audrey Gibson, voicing their support for her. People rallying in support, physically rallying in support of Dr. Diana Green. They are, in effect, accusing the Duval County School Board of exploiting the situation at Douglas Anderson to force Dr. Green out. What are those sources telling you?
Yeah, last night there was a demonstration in front of the Duval County School Board headquarters with a bunch of those folks you mentioned were either represented or specifically calling out, sharing that event. And their sentiment really is that what they believe is that the state Department of Education, the DeSantis administration, has kind of had it out for Dr. Green and any other superintendent that pushed back in any way against some of the state level policies that came out during the pandemic and since. It's that I'll point out that's a little. Dr. Green has been criticized on both sides. One, because saying that she's too woke of a superintendent. On the other side, saying that she didn't push back enough
hard
against
enough.
Some
yeah,
of the...
she's gotten so, it on both sides.
And I'll say, to your point of all the things that have come along during her tenure as superintendent, again, she was just re-upped. Her contract extended last year. She quarterbacked the school name change. It was her responsibility to figure out how the process of figuring out how the whether the district was going to decide on these hugely controversial school name changes, which took, as you remember, 11 months.
Right, going from Lee High School to Riverside High School.
Any superintendent who was working during the pandemic and seeing like entire districts go virtual, come back and figure out masks and vaccines, any superintendent working during that period would get like the equivalent of a military ribbon.
Sure.
on their chest.
It's a hugely stressful and difficult job. And, you know, when you look at the data on school superintendents, they rarely stay in a job more than 3 to 5 years for all of the reasons you're mentioning. But this has been an especially fraught tenure. Just due to events, due to circumstances.
One other thing to mention is the opposition or the dissatisfaction with Dr. Green, I believe what I'm hearing from our sources is that it's arising out of why didn't the district do more after the 2021 Clayton incident? Why wasn't anybody suspended? Why wasn't anybody? I think that may be coming from a lack of understanding of the whole situation. That may be something that they information share about this meeting on Wednesday, but I want to read the quote from school board chairwoman Dr. Kelly Coker, who spoke about this meeting yesterday. She says, this is the quote: "As a board, we are committed to hiring third-party counsel to complete an independent investigation of the events that led to the recent arrest of Jeffrey Clayton. The Douglas Anderson community and our community at large deserve our commitment to and focus on ensuring the safety and well-being of the students that attend Duval County Public Schools. Our meeting on Wednesday will move us closer to that goal." So she's clearly not saying anything about the superintendent. Mm-hmm. That may be an indication of some things perhaps still being up.
All righty. Let's go to some calls now as we talk about this. It's 549-2937. It looks like we have a former school board member on the line. It's former school board member Elizabeth Anderson. Hello, Elizabeth Anderson. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Hi, Joe. Thanks for having us and having this conversation here today.
Sure.
I was able to be at the rally last night because this has been, you know, widely talked about, you know, for some time now. And unfortunately, over the past year, I think we've watched the political pressures mount on Dr. Green. And before I left, you know, I said, we have to stay steadfast focus on children. I think she's tried to compromise to satisfy the voracious extremists to no avail. And that's put her in a position where she is, you know, been pinned.
I'm sorry to catch up. Issues. When you say voracious extremists, who do you mean? What do you mean by that?
I think we have seen, you know, folks coming to school board meetings, pounding on podiums and yelling at the school board and the superintendent, demanding, you know, things that work for them, but maybe not for all families, maybe not for all parents. When we're talking about sex ed curriculum, for example, or the book situation, or the safe space stickers. I mean, all of these things, I think, are issues that have distracted from education and learning, that are being yelled about by a vocal minority. And Dr. Green has tried to just satisfy them so she could get back to focusing on education. But the problem is you're not ever going to do enough for these people.
Let me ask you, you did lose your reelection to April Carney, a Moms for Liberty affiliated candidate who has given voice to the kinds of issues you're talking about. So is it your belief that the board is going to oust Dr. Green over the problems at Douglas Anderson?
You know what? I certainly hope not. I think that what we have heard so far coming out of Douglas Anderson is absolutely horrific. I think that the students and the families and the victims of this abuse deserve transparency in this process and real policy change and real procedure change, and not a political witch hunt. I think that we've seen, 9 out of 29 appointed superintendents across the state of Florida have either left or been removed since the elections. We know that there is a concerted strategic effort to oust superintendents that don't follow their political agenda. And if this is scapegoated on Dr. Green rather than having real changes made, that would be quite a shame.
All right. That's Elizabeth Anderson, former school board member. From her perspective, anyway, she feels we should look at these issues in the context of what's going on in districts around the state of Florida, where a number of superintendents have been pushed out by school boards in recent months.
And I would say few people are in a better position to understand how Dr. Green works and how school boards work, particularly work under pressure, than Elizabeth Anderson. She served as the board chair.
That's right.
During one of the most, you know, consequential pandemic-stricken years of Duval County Public Schools. And so I would say that's notable. I will say is particularly about people talking about curriculum, about books and stuff. I will say last night there was a meeting of the Instructional Review Committee of Duval County Public Schools. There was a book challenged, curriculum book, Human Kinetics, Reproductive and Sexual Health. That was reviewed, and it was unanimously upheld. So curriculum review committee is working. This has sort of been a cloud over the district all weekend.
The removal
ever
of
since
books.
The Wednesday report about this memo from the state last week.
All right.
Week.
Richard on the north side. Hi, Richard. You've been holding a bit. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. How are you? Thank
all
you
right.
for taking my call. One of the things that disturbs me most about what is happening is watching the media. And there, I grew up in a time when the media actually went out to get the news and brought the news to you. Now the media is reporting on the news, meaning that it becomes news that this man molested or did whatever he did to these children. And rather than going and getting the story about the real incident itself, we're reporting on what has happened because of the incident. And
well, to stick up for all of my colleagues in Jacksonville, no offense, Richard, people did report out the initial incidents, the allegations anyway.
Right. But as far as the media is concerned, if the media stays on the incident, then the children that were attacked will be getting justice. We're not talking about justice for the children. We're not talking about justice for the family. We are now literally talking about Dr. Green, one of the most celebrated school superintendents we've ever had, losing her job over the Marjorie Stillman Douglas Act, which was passed about school shootings. And I've never seen a school board superintendent held accountable for a shooting. We've never talked about holding anybody accountable for a shooting at the school board level, but we're going to hold this woman accountable for another man's. And I'm not going to make it about race. I'm just going to say it's somebody else's misdeed is now has this woman's job on the line. If we don't stop doing this and stop allowing the attack against the woke, after they have attacked the last person that's woke, they're going to go after all of those that are zombies that are thinking they're following along their great leader. We've got to stop the attack. Dr. Green deserves every bit of recognition. She needs to not be a part of this conversation. I'll give it that the principal that was there at the school should be held accountable, yes. But to talk about removing the school board superintendent as an attack against the woke mob, and because there's both sides and all that, there's no both sides to anything. There's one man who molested a child. He should go to jail. End of conversation.
All right, Richard. Joe.
And I think what we need to do is make sure to distinguish between a couple of different conversations. One is the situation with Jeffrey Clayton. This is a teacher accused of really terrible things. He's been removed. The superintendent, the district says it's going to look review. It's going to do an outside investigation. The board fully supports that. The other issue is how this type of thing is reported. Administratively, what happened on the district level, on the school level administration, on the district level administration, what was the system in place to sort of prevent, to catch this? Was it reported on time? Was it filed with the proper things? And that's the sort of administrative thing that we're looking at. So there's a situation with the teacher, which is that is newsworthy because this is a teacher who is in a position of public influence and yada, you know, everything like that. That's newsworthy. The situation with Dr. Green, her job being on the line affects the entire district because of how consequential of a position a superintendent is, particularly of a district the size of Duval County. Duval County is the 20th biggest district in the country. And so, two very newsworthy stories there to his point. And one shouldn't overpower the other, or they shouldn't be mixed up.
On Facebook, Jim says Dr. Green is objectively the best superintendent the city has had in decades. We will be a poor city without her. Another listener says, John says, I think this is nothing the administration at the school district probably wasn't aware of. On Twitter, Chris says, as bad as DA seems to be becoming, this could be cover because the governor was embarrassed over book bans and somebody had to pay for that. Another tweet from a listener, I'm a little confused about how the board will be able to do a clean evaluation of the facts. Wasn't the current board chair an assistant superintendent whose school assignments included Douglas Anderson some years back? If true, how can she appropriately oversee this? That's Chair Dr. Kelly Coker.
What I'm hearing from the school board or from people in the position to know multiple sources in the district. News 4 Jax has three different sources who say that the board members want accountability on every level. That is the quote, every level of the district. And other people, including city officials like Councilman Rory Diamond, have posted on social media overtly calling for Dr. Green to be fired for cause, he says. And the people who are coming to her defense are saying, DeSantis administration, a bunch of people have kind of had it out for Diana Green ever since, some of her policies.
Since the pandemic.
Pushing back against the pandemic, yeah.
Julia in Arlington. Hi, Julia.
Hey there. Sorry, I'm back here on the Mars, so I don't know if the phone's breaking up. Good morning. I learned that in life, nothing you do to other people will go is a boomerang. And it really is real. I was a teacher. I was set up. I tried to go to VD. He left. When Diane Green came in, Dr. Green, I emailed her. She said, what do you want me to do about it? So I gave up. I'm like, okay, she's not the one that's going to do anything about it. And I moved on with my life. There's an ethics department at the school board, but they're biased. If I could tell y'all, it's like they already have their minds up because whoever's in power, the principals, whoever, basically give them a directive and they go looking for it instead of trying to disprove it. So I'm not happy this is happening, but what people need to understand is people get off on technicalities all the time. They did the crime, but because of a technicality, and people get accused and basically ousted because of technicalities. When we don't stand up for each other collectively, they gonna continue to do this to everyone. This is nothing new. When it happened to me, I was shocked. But what I learned is this is a playbook. They try to vilify you. If they can't kill you physically, they gonna kill you spiritually. They gonna take your income away. She gonna be fine. It's gonna happen. But we need to vote, and people need to stop picking sides, and we need to just come together as humanity. Because this is going to continue to happen, not just to her, not just to me, but to anyone that stands up against us. They're looking for something. And when I say they, I mean racist people that's been around since the beginning of time that's held our city back. And they're going to keep doing it because they can get away with it.
All right, Julia. I think we should point out that the top Black female political leaders in the city are speaking up for Dr. Diana Green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that is an element of this controversy.
It is. Looking at I go back to the impact that Diana Green has had on the district through seeing it through the pandemic, seeing it through controversies, either real or manufactured. And again, she's been, like I said earlier, criticized by all spectrums. I almost think, in my time reporting on education, that a superintendent's job is so often thankless. But a couple things about
Dominican. Like I said, they typically last 3 to 5 years. Yeah. In any that is the national standard.
It's
a stressful, tough job in any circumstance.
And a couple other things to note about Diana Greene and her current status. Again, she was named Superintendent of the Year, very prestigious, sought after accolade. In 2021, she was Superintendent of the Year. She's currently in what's called DROP status, which is the deferred retirement option program for employees, meaning
instead of Social Security.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what they have. Yeah.
And so essentially she's able to step down whenever she wants at this point. But her contract, which just renewed last summer, extends out to 2026. They renewed her contract for 4 years. So but as of now, the meeting on Wednesday doesn't explicitly say we're going to be talking about Diana Greene. Really, they're just saying we're going to be responding to what's going on at Douglas Anderson.
We'll follow it. Always good to get your insights. Joe McClain at our partner News for Jax. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, much more still ahead later. North Florida TPO wants your help as they work to connect sidewalks, hiking trails, and bike paths across the First Coast. We'll tell you all about it, but up next.
There are several factors that can impact a couple's fertility, and overall health really plays a big role.
How couples struggling with infertility can access new solutions. It's National Infertility Awareness Week. More on that next. Well, it's a national movement bringing together millions of Americans who want to remove stigmas and barriers that stand in the way of building their families. This week is National Infertility Awareness Week. With a closer look at the state of infertility in the U.S. and new options for couples, we spoke with Lena Fouad, MD. She's a reproductive surgical specialist at Brown Fertility in Jacksonville.
Dr. Fouad, it's good to have you as we mark Infertility Awareness Week. So what are the biggest factors affecting infertility and why is it so increasingly prevalent across the country?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. There are several factors that can impact a couple's fertility. And overall health really plays a big role. So for example, lifestyle, diet can affect hormonal imbalances and cycle irregularities, and that can impact fertility windows. So that's what we're seeing that can affect a couple's ability to get pregnant. And also, we're seeing a trend where people are waiting to have kids. So advanced maternal age, you know, careers are very important, so women are delaying childbearing, and the odds of getting pregnant decrease as you age. Unfortunately, we can't reverse that biological clock.
Sure, particularly in the late 30s to the 40s. So considering COVID-19, inflation, stress, everything that's going on in our daily lives, how big a factor is stress when it comes to fertility rates?
That's a great question. It is, however, a misperception. Stress does not clinically really play a role in someone's ability to get pregnant. Overall, we don't want you to be stressed. We want this process to be as worry-free as possible. It's really more other factors and not so much stress.
Okay. You know, it's funny, though, anecdotally, you always hear these stories about couples that try and try to get pregnant and they can't. And then they finally give up And then when they give up and they're not stressed out about it anymore, they get pregnant. And people hold the perception that, well, they got pregnant because they just weren't stressed and worried anymore. What is that, just an urban legend?
I think there's the truth about that is when you're not stressed out, you're probably having more regular intercourse around the fertility window. So that's probably where it can play a role. But stress in and of itself does not affect your biologic fertility.
Okay. Well, we know about IVF, in vitro fertilization, and other technologies. So what's the most popular way now to treat couples dealing with this? And do you have concerns about legislation effective reproductive health, like IVF and other methods, impacting your ability to help couples get pregnant?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great question. So at first, when we see a couple, we go over their chances of fertility naturally and how to increase their chances of getting pregnant on their own. Typically, when we see them, they're ready to try a treatment. And our first line is ovulation induction pills, or ovulation stimulation pills, where we stimulate the ovaries to create a follicle for that given month. And we pair that with insemination, where we concentrate the sperm and put it the right place at the right time. And that's a simple procedure. So typically couples start with that before we move on to IVF or in vitro fertilization.
And are you watching what's going on politically? Because there are those lawmakers and groups that would like to restrict even access to in vitro fertilization.
Yes, yeah, we're definitely watching that closely. We are seeing, however, more and more insurance carriers covering infertility treatments, which is wonderful for patients, and it definitely takes away barriers for couples who are trying to have a baby. Mm-hmm. So we're excited to see that with the insurance carriers. We have a great financial department that's very familiar with all the insurance carriers and helps couples figure out, you know, what's covered and what's not, and can they afford this? And it really is affordable when you look at it, especially when you compare it to the alternatives like going childless or adoption.
All right. So what's the benchmark for when people should turn to a fertility doctor?
Yeah, so it's really any time you're asking the question. By definition, infertility is a year of trying to conceive without success when you're under 35, and it's 6 months when you're over 35 of trying to conceive without success. But that, you know, you can pull that trigger earlier, specifically because if there is an issue, you really don't want to wait that 6 to 12 months. By definition, those are the time intervals. It's really when you're trying to conceive and it's not successful.
And what about people increasingly looking at freezing eggs to try to get pregnant later in life?
Yes, that is something we definitely offer and very excited about that. Basically, you freeze your eggs at a younger age, so later on in life, you can have a family on your own terms. So typically we see patients wanting to freeze their eggs in their early 30s or even their late 20s, and that's really the ideal time because the age of the female is really what kind of dictates success rates, and it's basically the biggest determinant of fertility potential. So the earlier, the better.
The earlier, the better. And then finally, what's one thing about infertility most people might not realize?
Yeah, so infertility is not just a woman's issue. It can be male factor, so up to 30%. And you know, some people can even push it to, some people say it's 50% of fertility is caused by male factor. So that, you know, we're not in it alone. It can be a combined male and female factor or just a male factor. There are basically many options to treat infertility, and it's not as expensive as people think it is. So I think that can be a barrier to some couples trying to conceive. And those are things I can think of.
Yeah. Well, it is Infertility Awareness Week, so thanks for providing your insights. She's Lena Fuad, MD, Reproductive Surgical Specialist at Brown Fertility. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's called The Quiet Epidemic, a new film looking at the toll of Lyme disease and the controversy many patients face in getting an accurate diagnosis.
You could do all the right things and get bit by a tick, and it'll change your world forever.
I was having a lot of patients coming into my office with bullseye rashes. And about 80% would get better with antibiotics, but 20% would not.
Here's a disease that's affecting a lot of people, can be costly, and there's been a very active effort to define not Lyme disease away, but chronic Lyme disease away.
They saw nothing wrong in the laboratory test, and they figured she must be faking it.
This is one of the most controversial, divisive debates in medicine today.
The Lyme disease bacteria. All right, The Quiet Epidemic screens Thursday night on the UNF campus, followed by a panel discussion. So why is Lyme disease controversial, and what's going on with chronic Lyme disease? Here with more, we welcome Dr. Carrie Clark, professor of epidemiology and environmental health at UNF. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Dr. Shirley Hartman, a family practice physician who treats Lyme disease patients here in our city. Good morning to you, doctor.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Dr. Clark, let's begin with you. Nearly 500,000 people are diagnosed with Lyme disease every year. About 10 to 20% of them go on to suffer long-term debilitating symptoms, and many more just never can get an accurate diagnosis at all. So years ago, you came on this program and talked about your research showing that people are getting bitten by ticks down here in the Southeast and getting Lyme disease, which went against the conventional wisdom, right?
Yes, it did. And I'm sorry to say that we haven't made a whole lot of progress in convincing the medical and scientific communities of that reality. But you have to keep in mind that those numbers from the CDC, as staggering as they are, those are people that actually get confirmed positive. And so the real number could be even more than that. But one of the great myths about Lyme disease still is that it doesn't occur in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors continue to tell patients here in our local community that there is no Lyme disease in Florida. That is absolutely untrue. And, you know, we have to get past this point. There are so many people suffering in our community. I know I do research testing on human patients. And I can pick up the organism's DNA in some super sensitive research testing methods that I have. So I know that these people have these infections.
So Dr. Hartman, you treat patients who come to you in desperation when they think they have Lyme disease, they can't get a proper diagnosis. This is the story that's being told in this film, The Quiet Epidemic. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, the problem is that my mnemonic is that when people have pain, brain, and lame, that they need to look into being tested for Lyme disease. So pain, nerve pain, joint pain, muscle pain, brain, like cognitive dysfunction, even psychiatric diagnosis, anxiety, depression, brain fog, and then lame, people who have chronic fatigue, autoimmune disorders, fibromyalgia, fatigue. Those are people that, you know, if people have all of those systems affected, mm-hmm. that should get testing for Lyme. But the difficulty is that the CDC says that you have to have five IgG bands or two IgM bands in order to diagnose Lyme.
What's an IgM band?
IgM is like a recent antibody, and IgG is long-term antibody.
Okay.
But the difficulty with Lyme is that it causes immune suppression. So the testing that we use for Lyme is inherently flawed. The other problem is that the organisms that you see in the north are more likely to give a positive Western blot than the organisms that we tend to see in the south. So even when people meet the far too stringent CDC criteria for Lyme disease, they're often told that they don't have Lyme disease.
They're gaslit, you're saying.
Yes.
Medical gaslighting. Dr. Clark, why is there such institutional resistance to acknowledging this diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease, and also that you can get the disease down here in this part of the country?
Well, first of all, as far as the chronic Lyme, maybe it has something to do with not wanting to admit the limitations of modern medicine, that we can't eradicate, you know, a particular infection with a short course of antibiotics. Maybe it's because early on that wasn't part of the paradigm. But this testing approach is really problematic because of the limitations of the sensitivity of antibody testing. And right now, the limitations of sensitivity of DNA testing still at the clinical labs. People, you know, just can't get a diagnosis. And because clinical diagnosis is not being made, we've relied so heavily upon technology over the years for infections that there's just a lack of acknowledgement of these stealth pathogens that don't cause this rapid, severe, life-threatening illness immediately. Actually, they get in and they just persist. They establish a chronic infection and they hang around and they make you miserable.
Like long COVID, kind of?
Absolutely. It can be misdiagnosed. I don't want to overstep my field of practice here, so I'd refer to Dr. Hartman on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I have something to say on that front. The symptoms of long COVID, with the exception of loss of taste and smell, are identical to the symptoms of Lyme. And those of us in the field are suspicious that some of the people with long COVID actually had underlying Lyme disease that was never diagnosed. And when their immune system was knocked back by the COVID virus, now all of their Lyme systems come barreling forward. And COVID is a chronic virus as well, like Epstein-Barr.
Got it. So with all of that said, the Quiet Epidemic screens Thursday night on the UNF campus, followed by a Q&A. How can people come out and see this film?
They can go to the Florida Lyme Disease Association website and find some information about how to register for the event, or they can just Google the Quiet Epidemic and they'll have information for how to get to us. It's $10 for most folks, but students are free regardless of where they're a student.
Where on the campus will you screen it?
It will be at the Adam Herbert University Center. Very easy access.
Right off Kernan Boulevard.
Free parking, yes.
7 p.m. Thursday night.
It'll be 6 p.m.
6 we'll p.m. Start. Thursday night. Yep. Come on out, folks, particularly if you or a loved one is dealing with what you think might be Lyme disease. A screening of The Quiet Epidemic, 6 p.m. Thursday at the Herbert University Center on the UNF campus.
Something else that I would like to offer as a resource for people is that on the mandarinwellness.com website, we have videos and information on Lyme, including an herbal treatment regimen.
Thank you, Dr. Shirley Hartman and Dr. Carrie Clark of UNF.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
In a moment, the North Florida TPO needs your help to connect the region's sidewalks, hiking trails, and bike lanes. We'll tell you how next.
Are you passionate about public media and want to make a difference in your community? Then apply to become a WJCT Public Media Community Advisory Board member. As a CAB member, you'll have the opportunity to provide valuable feedback and input on programming, outreach, and engagement efforts at your local public media organization. Visit wjct.org/cab to learn more and submit your application.
The Jacksonville Music Experience is proud to present Mdou Mokhtar at Intuition Aleworks as part of our JME Presents Music Discovery Series on Tuesday, May 2nd. The Touareg musician, singer, songwriter, and activist is arguably one of the best guitarists working today. For tickets and more information, visit jacksmusic.org/events.
On the next Fresh Air, Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. We talk with journalist Virginia Soul Smith. In her new book, she argues that efforts to fight childhood obesity have caused kids to absorb an onslaught of body shaming from peers, school, diet culture, and parents themselves. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Few issues are as complex or as personal as infertility, and it's more common than most think. A new report says it affects 1 in 6 people. Next time on 1A, we look at fertility care, the financial and emotional costs involved, and the struggle to make treatments more accessible and much more affordable.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to help the North Florida TPO complete a regional bicycle and pedestrian master plan so that they can look at ways to connect sidewalks, paved trails, and bicycle paths throughout Northeast Florida. If you live in Clay, Duval, Nassau, or St. John's counties, you can give your opinion. Jeff Sheffield, president of North Florida TPO, is here in studio with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
You too.
And we should disclose you're an underwriter here at WJCT. So tell us about this North Florida Bicycle and Pedestrian Study.
Well, it's something we do about every 5 years. Obviously, we know the area continues to rank highly nationally. So it's important for us to continue to look at ways to improve that. This particular effort is obviously focused more on facilities. So we want to take a look, and we hope that the folks within the region will participate in our survey really to share their concerns, but also help us understand where our gaps are and allow us the opportunity to create projects that we can fund and continue to move the needle, at least on the facility side of things.
So you want to make the region, I guess, more friendly for pedestrians
Correct.
And cyclists?
Yeah, it's a pretty novel concept, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a challenge, though, because it's not any one thing to address it. Obviously, within the context of this, it's about building more infrastructure. But certainly the goal in the end is to make safer facilities across the region and encourage bike and ped use.
All you have to do is go on your website, northflbikepedstudy.com. If you live anywhere in the Ford County area and you ride a bicycle or you ever walk around, basically you're qualified to take this survey, right?
Pretty much. And it's only 16 quick little multiple choice questions. Shouldn't take but just a minute or two. But it's really important for us to get insight. I can tell you that surveys in this subject matter tend to draw a lot of attention. So we encourage those folks again to participate. It really is important.
I'll say this several more times so people can do this later today. It's northflbikepedstudy.com. So you take this data, which I think you do a really good job of at North Florida TPO. It's a data-driven organization. You really like the data from the public to help plan out the grid, the infrastructure web of this whole region.
We do, and it's large, 2,600 square miles. So we really do need the input because it's certainly a challenge to think that we can accommodate that level of area.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure we're focusing on those critical destinations, areas of population, and dig in to what concerns and the input of a single person sharing something on their particular route that they may take is very important to us.
Because people do want a more walkable city, and we're not, unless you live in one of the historic neighborhoods, we're not known, and few Florida cities are known as walkable cities
or
safe cities for cyclists.
For sure. And I think we have to be cognizant of how we address that.
Mm-hmm.
To think that we can accommodate 2,600 square miles is probably not realistic. So our ability to take that region and focus on those areas, the St. Augustines, the Fernandinas, the downtowns, the beaches, areas that we know have population and activity, and let's very, very concentrated in those areas in terms of how we make investments.
So based on the data, that will enable you to decide, say, well, this would be a perfect place to put in a bike path to connect this sidewalk to this hiking yes. trail. Are you coordinating at all with the people behind the Emerald Trail, for example? That's
Absolutely.
Going to be a connected bike and cyclist greenbelt.
It certainly all fits in the mix. Obviously, from our perspective, we're dealing with not just sidewalks and bike lanes within the roads. We have historically funded multi-use trails like the Jackson mm-hmm. Baldwin Trail and others. The TPO is part of the Emerald Trail project. And a lot of this is on the backdrop, too, of legislation currently in Tallahassee that looks to bring an additional $250 million to multi-use trails should that
wow.
materialize. So we want to be in the pipeline yeah. For a number of reasons. So what we're looking to develop from this plan is every type of facility that folks would be using.
So folks, if you have 5 minutes, this is so quick and easy, and you will be making a difference and making this community more friendly to pedestrians and cyclists. Go to the North Florida TPO's Bicycle and Pedestrian Survey online. It's at northflbikepedstudy.com, northflbikepedstudy.com. If you live in Clay, Duval, Nassau, or St. John's counties, and you use bicycle or pedestrian systems like sidewalks, we all do that, bike lanes, anything like that. Basically, this is open to everyone. Go online and complete this quick survey and help the North Florida TPO design bicycle and pedestrian paths you will love to use. Help make this a more walkable and cyclist-friendly community. Again, northflbikepedstudy.com. Check it out. People have a few more weeks to fill it
sure.
out, right, Jeff?
Yes. Yes. And by all means, go fill it out. We'll keep taking it in.
Jeff Sheffield, president at North Florida TPO. Always good to see you. Thanks.
You too.
I'll be filling it out today myself. Thanks so much for being with us. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks also to our team. They love to walk and bicycle all over the place. David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella De Silva, Michelle Corum, and theme music by Club De Belucas. I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News 89.9 Jax. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.